basically that reef.
This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it is March the 28th. March is just flying away. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5524 and invite back Mr. Cannon and company. And Doug, anything before we start?
Chair, you'll have to return to yesterday's date and pick up the what we plan to do, at least at this stage, is as they finish up, there's now 4 days of materials for the first 4 days. We'll keep adding to that, so we'll keep going back to that day. I will be posting some more responses to ODE, the last sort of few questions they have, and I'll post it on ODE's days. So I think that with that, we're fine.
Ben, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Before I get going, picking up where we left off yesterday, I'll draw your attention to a letter that you either just received or will receive shortly that answers some of the questions that arose during yesterday's presentation. Describe the progress that's been made towards the 40-40-20 goal in response to the question that Representative Senator Roblin asked about the trends since 2011. So you'll see some charts that show that steady increase in the percentage of adult Oregonians who have earned a bachelor's degree or higher, as well as a small increase in the percentage who've earned that middle 40 certificate. We have provided a chart, a reformatted chart that occupation bubbles chart that describes presents the same data, but by the competitive level of education. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics and Oregon Employment Department describe projected job openings based on the minimum educational qualifications, but they also do the same thing based on what a job seeker would need in order to be competitive in the position, and you'll see many more blue and green circles when you look at it that way. We described the Bureau of Labor Statistics methodology in response to a question that Representative Parrish asked, and we also look at those job recovery, job loss and recovery data chart based on the percentage of Americans in each category by level of education, again, in response to a question from Senator Roblin. So, of course, if you have follow-up questions about our responses to your questions, happy to take those under consideration as well. We're picking up on page or slide 37 continuing on. Yesterday, we described in our kind of introductory presentation the state structure for higher education, talked about the HECS role in that, little of the recent history that created the structure that we have today. We talked about return on investment and state goals and progress towards them. Today, we'll look in more detail at the students within Oregon's higher education system, the structure, again, of our institutions and organizations. We'll turn and spend significant time beginning the conversation about funding and look at Oregon funding for higher education in a national context and start to drill down into some key components of the higher education budget in Oregon.
I love all your pictures. The kids are always smiling and happy. And I remember my days in college, it was a struggle.
They were posing.
Ah, okay.
That's right. So, this slide that I'll step through, it's an animated slide, is an attempt at a very high level to provide a snapshot of Oregon's students. And we take Oregon as 100 college students and go ahead. So here are your 100. If Oregon was 100 college students, this is students at degree-granting institutions, both public and private, 62% of them intend or are enrolled full-time, 38% part-time. I have to sort of provide a caveat on this. This data comes from the national reporting system, IPEDS, and it significantly undercounts the part-time enrollment, particularly at community colleges, for reasons that I won't get into, in part because I don't entirely understand. But take this 38% part-time as a minimum. It's likely much higher. than that. Moving on, financial aid. 82% of our Oregon has 100 college students. 82%, 82 of them received financial aid. 18% did not. We can look at the learning environment. 74% of Oregon higher education students attend in a classroom-only environment. 16% are enrolled in a classroom and online, a sort of blended environment, and 10% are enrolled in online programs exclusively. 53% of our Oregon is 100 college students attend a four-year school, 47% a two-year school. Gender, so looking at some demographic information now, 54% are female, 46% male. Age, I'll draw your attention here to the significant percentages that are older than traditional age students. So we have 38% in that 20 to 24-year-old category. But 13% in the 25 to 29 and 22% who are older than the age of 30. And then by race, ethnicity, you see here the breakdown by race.
Ben, when I went to college, boys outnumbered girls about 2 to 1. Now it's almost the reverse of that. It's been a dramatic shift gender-wise in educational attainment and matriculation by gender. Do we know why that's happened?
Senator Monroe, members of the committee, I don't have a sort of ready answer to that question. But it is certainly the case that those patterns have shifted. And, of course, females graduate, complete high school at higher rates than males, and matriculate in college at higher rates and complete college at higher rates than males.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So the assumption I make when I look at the age is it's somewhat quite a bit influenced by community college versus four-year from a standpoint of the age, but I don't have anything to base that on other than that's my thought.
Representative Lively, Senator Monroe, yes. The older students here, the fact that, you know, 22% of the students who were, you know, finding in the federal data system are older than the age of 30, those are predominantly at community colleges. And in fact, are probably underrepresented in this data, again, because of some of the limitations of the federal data source from which it's derived. Move on. So where are these students enrolled? So here's our community college population, almost 300,000 headcount students. So this is not full-time equivalent enrollment. These are actual individuals in community colleges. And there could be some duplication if a student if the same student was enrolled in multiple colleges over the course of the year, which does happen. They'll be counted in each head count. But nevertheless, this 300,000 gives you an approximation of Oregonians enrolled in community colleges. The size of the bubble represents approximately the size of the college by head count enrollment. So you see our 17 there. You see our seven public universities with their corresponding headcount of about 131,000. We have an additional almost 3,000 enrolled at Oregon Health Sciences University, over 40,000 enrolled at private degree-granting post-secondary institutions, and finally over 13,000 enrolled at private career schools. Just to sort of distinguish between those final two categories, and we'll be coming back to this when we talk about our Office of Private Post-Secondary Education, but those 43,000, those are degree-granting private institutions. They include Willamette, they include Lewis and Clark, they include some degree-granting institutions that are licensed and regulated by the HEC. And private career schools are certificate-granting institutions. They don't offer associate's degrees or bachelor's degrees. They tend to be very trade-focused and offer certificates in everything from cosmetology to truck driving to other tax preparation and other fields. So that's a snapshot of Oregon's current higher education enrollment. This is pretty interesting. To put it in a national context, since 2008, Oregon is number three in the country in the percentage increase in full-time equivalent enrollment. So starting in the recession, all states practically saw fairly significant increases in enrollment. Oregon saw higher than average and almost the highest in the country. This is now focused just on our public institutions. It was driven primarily, although not exclusively, by the surge of enrollment in community colleges. Enrollment, as you'll see in a few slides, at all of our public institutions has leveled off since the sort of boom years of 2008 to 2013. Nevertheless, as of fiscal year 15, which is the last most recent year where we had these national comparisons on enrollment, Oregon was number three in the country on the percentage increase in enrollment, and that created both opportunities but also strains at in both sectors as state funding diminished until 2015, and we'll look at that in a few minutes, even as enrollment increased. When we look ahead, these are now contain both sort of actual data as well as projected data of high school graduates. So if we start to do what university admissions offices have to do in trying to project the future enrollment and future market for higher education, we see that while Oregon's overall high school graduate population is not expected to increase significantly in the years to come, we do expect to see significant additional diversity in Oregon's high school graduates, and that's reflected in the particular the sort of increasing significant increase in the number of Hispanic or Latino students who are projected to graduate from Oregon high schools between now and its peak in about 2024-25. Again, these are projections. They take into account certain things but not others, and should be treated as such. So moving on now to completion. So we talked about enrollment. This slide depicts the number of completions, so certificates and degrees awarded to students by our public and private sector. So we'll display them here by sector, and then the total of over 67,000 degrees and certificates earned at Oregon institutions of higher education in 2016. This is a big number, and likely was a record number of degrees and certificates. We don't have this corresponding data going back for every year. We haven't had a heck that looked broadly at public and private higher education in the same way until just the last few years. But this is a reflection of this large number is a reflection, of course, of the surge of enrollment that occurred during and following the recession. It's a reflection of the increasing productivity or success rates of students at our community colleges and public universities, and likely at our private institutions as well. Just for context, I mean, 67,000 sort of hard to perhaps make a lot of sense of what that means, but a sort of birth cohort in Oregon is roughly 50,000 a year. So this is a healthy level of degree and certificate production by Oregon institutions. It again is likely the sort of high watermark. To be clear, this does include some non-resident students who came to Oregon to study at mostly universities, public and private. And some of those students will stay and become, you know, taxpayers and contributors and residents of the state of Oregon. Trends. So this is, again, is completion data, basically the same thing that you were just looking at, but now focused just on the public sector. So these are just from our public institutions. The last slide was that global public and private. But now looking just at our public institutions and breaking down completions by bachelor's degrees, associate's degrees, undergraduate certificates, and advanced degrees, you'll see pretty steep increases going back to since 2006, 2007. So we're awarding nearly a third more bachelor's degrees today than we were in 2006, 2007. nearly double the number of associate's degrees as we were in 06, 07. The graduate degrees, advanced degrees are basically flat, but a very significant increase in the number of undergraduate certificates that are awarded principally by community colleges. And when we spend more time looking at that sector specifically, we'll get more detail on what types of certificates those are and some of the drivers of that growth. But on the whole, this very significant and heartening increase in certificate and degree completion at Oregon public institutions can be attributed, again, to rising enrollment, rising rates of success, an increase in focus by the institutions on degree and certificate completion. To put that in a national context, again, looking back over time and comparing the rate of increase at Oregon at Oregon institutions in the number of certificates and degrees, degrees awarded since 2008, number three in the country. So Oregon, a nearly 37% increase in the number of degrees awarded since 2008, outpacing in percentage terms every other state in the country besides Georgia and Arkansas. So Oregon, again, a very significant uptick in both enrollment and completion since 2008. On the enrollment side, again, just to remind you, 20% increase since 2008. On the completion side, degree completion side, 36% increase in degree completion. So these are, again, positive stories of the very significant new level of energy and success within the Oregon higher education sector since 2008.
And yet we're accomplishing that with really less total funding.
Senator Monroe, members, yes, and we're going to look at the funding trends in just a few minutes, and you'll see that pretty directly. I do want to sort of, before we leave this enrollment and completion, just a little warning that these very steep increases are very likely to flatten in the years to come as we in a sense, stop enjoying the results, the yield of that very significant surge in enrollment that was recession-driven. And just to make perhaps, just to state the obvious, during the recession in Oregon, as in other states, many people who could not find work went back to school. And that's a well-understood and predicted phenomenon in higher education generally. It is, in a sense, a kind of counter-cyclical industry where, as the economy does better, fewer students show up to colleges and universities, particularly community colleges. And when we look at those enrollment numbers, you'll see that reflected.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director Cannon, I hate to say this, but Georgia and Arkansas, have you analyzed this? They don't have a reputation, I don't think. looking for Massachusetts, Minnesota, they usually are looked at as one of the, okay, Massachusetts is pretty high. Just any comments on the top two?
Representative Wisnett, co-chair's known. Not really. I mean, Georgia has actually very vibrant and well-regarded higher education sector. But I can't speak to specifically what's occurred in those states.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
This is percentage of growth, not how many kids there are. And so, I mean, if you start out low, your growth can go up much quicker than the other places. So there are, you know, we make judgments about graphs sometimes that are not related to the actual thing that the graph is trying to look at. So, you know, I think we're going to see a growth for a while just because if Promise continues to get enrollment in community colleges as high as it is and they continue to have the results, which is not over 90% continuing to the next year, if those guys all get their associate's degrees, we'll see another little uptick for a while. And then I would agree with Ben about the leveling off. There will come a point, but I mean, our junior college admissions were pretty high last time as well, in large part because of that.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I I guess my comment or question has to do with, you made a comment about how many people went back during the recession and that. We hear a lot about how prepared or unprepared our high school students are to go to college. It would be interesting to me to understand, out of that substantial increase in degrees or certificates, how many of those people got that were people that had been in the workforce and came back and did that, versus those, the percent that were just from high school straight into those institutions. I don't know that there's any correlation there, but to me it'd be interesting to find out, given the conversations we have about the success of high school students versus those that may have been in the workforce for a while and gone back. But I don't know if there's any way to...
Representative Lively, members of the committee, we can attempt to sort of to kind of trace that in the data. I would just say now that the very significant swings in enrollment and degree completion are likely mostly associated with the non-traditional students who are most subject to the economic swings, right? The percentage of our recent high school graduates who enroll directly into community college or public university is a much more stable number, and we will present some of that data too, and see ways that, for example, the Oregon Promise is helping to influence and increase the number of students who go directly from high school to college. But that overall is a much more stable figure than the adult population, which is just much more conditioned by the economy.
Thank you.
Spend just a couple of slides on cost and affordability as we continue the overview here, understanding that we'll get much more into this over the next couple of days. But tuition and fees, this is just a little bit of history in both our public university and community college sector. Those top two lines are the public university tuition and fees and community college tuition and fees. Going back to 2007, 2008, you see the very significant increases in both. This is part of what drives the affordability challenge that students are facing, although it's certainly not the entirety of that challenge, and we'll talk more about those factors starting later today or tomorrow. The bottom line is the opportunity grant, the maximum opportunity grant award, which has been relatively flat since 2010. We've made slight, in a sense, inflationary increases, and it now maxes out at about $2,250 a year. That's our need-based scholarship program that we'll be talking quite a bit about probably the day after tomorrow.
Back in the 09 session, I remember a significant drive to increase student aid to aid those students that were out of the workforce and that were looking to improve their education level, and you can see that bump there, that bubble, where we actually increased student aid rather dramatically during the height of the recession.
Senator Monroe, yes, and we'll look more at that again, likely the day after tomorrow or on the following day, and talk about what occurred during that time period. Just one more overview slide on affordability. We've just described tuition and fees, but of course students face total costs that are significantly greater than tuition and fees. So while, for example, at Oregon Public Universities this year, average tuition and fees were just over $9,000, average total costs were in the $24,000 range. So that includes textbooks, room, board, transportation, et cetera. Likewise, at community colleges, while tuition and fees come in for a full-time student at just under $5,000, the total cost to a student would be closer to $18,000. When we look at whether that's affordable, and we'll have much more to say about this coming up, but we would note that for community college students in 2015-16, three-quarters had unmet financial need, according to their FAFSA, their free application for federal student aid. Three-quarters had unmet need after any grant aid and their expected family contribution had been applied. Many families struggled to meet even that expected family contribution. That's what the form says that they should be able to afford, but unless they have saved, it's quite possible that they have difficulty even meeting that expectation, all of which contributes to the borrowing that the majority of our students do today. This is just a slide that notes several of the key performance measures that are associated with some of the work and data that we've just described. So we're happy to come back with additional reports on any of these, should you wish. But much of the data that we've just depicted is reflected in these KPMs. We've linked to our full KPM report through our website, and that URL is at the bottom of this slide. So we wanted to spend a few minutes now on the history, a quick history of higher education funding. Again, looking at Oregon kind of globally, our funding for higher education. We're not going to spend a lot of time today on each of the respective sectors or drilling down to a great level of detail, but look at some of the overall trends and look at Oregon in a national context. Start with this sort of slide, which is a lot of information, most of which I don't necessarily want to spend any time on. This is a, but I'll draw your attention to at least one key feature. This is a slide that shows per student funding in Oregon for public higher education by year, going back to 1990 and through FY15, which is 2014-15. And the green and brown bars represent, the green bar is state and local appropriations per FTE, so how much the public is investing through government. The brown is the student investment. That's net tuition revenue per student. And the big takeaway from this slide is the very significant shift from 1990, when we had primarily a state-funded, a publicly funded higher education system, to 2015, where that ratio has been essentially flipped, and students are bearing a significant majority of the costs associated with higher education. This has been inflation adjusted, so you can see the overall slight increase in overall costs per student, but not great.
Thank you. That's what I'm trying to get to. So are so inflation adjusted? How?
Representative Smith Warner, Senator Monroe, members of the committee. So this uses a
what's your base
higher
dollar?
Education cost adjustment. So it's a national model that sort of simulates expected inflation within the higher education sector. Most of our slides that use inflation adjustment use the more common and sort of conventional consumer price index. This particular chart, which comes from a national source, uses a special higher education cost adjustment that we'd be happy to provide more information about the methodology for. It's not ours, but it is used nationally.
So I'm mostly, if I may follow.
Go ahead.
Because I'm mostly trying to get a sense of the appropriations per FTE and kind of how to, you know, put that into context. Yeah, that's the end of that sentence.
Representative Smith Warner, Senator Monroe, members of the committee, in about three slides, we'll present that appropriations per FTE by sector for Oregon, and we'll use our a more conventional inflation index.
It is not insignificant that this chart starts in 1990, which happened to be the year that Measure 5, the property tax limitation measure, passed, which has dramatically changed school funding, not only for K-12, but as you can see, also for higher ed. Representative Thompson, or Senator Thompson.
Kind of coincidentally, too, it's pretty close to when we quit cutting timber, too.
Representative Hernandez.
I'm going to backtrack a little bit, Mr. Chair, if that's okay. Can we go back to the KPM real quick? And I have a question. I looked up all the KPMs. Does the commission approve the KPMs or the legislature?
Representative Hernandez, co-chairs, KPMs themselves, and I'll be corrected, are adopted by the legislature or set by the legislature. Then we report on them. So it would be this committee and the legislature's decision to modify our KPMs.
KPMs are recommended by an agency, but they are adopted by the legislature. So, Mr. Wilson?
I was just going to say basically the same thing. As part of your budget approval, we'll make LFO make recommendations to you of changes if need be, and then you basically reaffirm those that aren't being changed. And as part of the budget report process.
Go ahead.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I noticed that at the beginning of the presentation, there was an emphasis and focus on equity work, and none of the KPMs seem to point to that direction. And I clicked on the link on the bottom and looked at all of them, and none of them seem to try to point at that direction, although overall one can argue that these in general can point to that direction, but nothing specific. So the agency is the one that recommends it to the LFO, and then we approve it.
Representative Hernandez, co-chairs, we would be happy to work with the subcommittee on updates to the KPMs that bring forward that emphasis more. I would note from this list, and this is not the entire list, but it sounds like you've looked at it, KPM number 20 does report the university graduation rate for non-traditional students. It is also the case that at the commission level and in the type of reporting that we do publicly via our website, back to institutions in a variety of ways and to the public, many of the KPMs described here, we also report on a disaggregated basis. Our commission has asked us to do that and to present data to them and broken down by on a demographic basis. So we would be happy to work to bring that lens more clearly forward through the official KPM should the subcommittee like to see that.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
You bet.
So this is slide number 51, and it now the view is back to 1999, that biennium. We're looking just at community college funding now, and this is not per FTE. This is the total state appropriation in millions for community colleges. So this is essentially your community college support fund. This is what the community colleges come and advocate to you for. It is the main source of state funding that they receive. We have seen a significant drop in community college support fund in 2007-09. It hit in a sense a high water mark and then was cut pretty significantly during those difficult budget years of 09 and 11. And then this slide reflects the very significant reinvestment that was made in 2015-17. The final two bars on the right-hand side here are the proposed governor's budget at basically flat funding for the Community College Support Fund, and then the current service level budget is in that shaded blue bar. The
Senator Roblin?
Yeah, it's taken me a while to get them compared, but that enrollment graph, the red line, and the one in the previous one are similar, but the other one's much smoother, so I don't know what's going on there. I was just trying to figure that out. But
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, a couple of things. The prior slide is total public higher education enrollment, not just community colleges, so this focus is just on community colleges. This also takes it forward another couple of years, because this is our data, not the national data, we're able to bring it into a little bit more contemporary perspective. And you're right, that enrollment line is the state community college enrollment going back to 99, and it reflects that very significant increase during the recession and the fact that we've now returned essentially to pre-recession levels in FTE, full-time equivalent enrollment. The only other thing I was going to note about this slide, and it becomes particularly relevant on the next slide, which is another version of this but for public universities, is the little brown bar at the bottom, which is state paid debt service for community college capital bonds. So as the legislature chooses to authorize the sale of capital bonds to support community colleges, we incur years, decades of debt service as interest payments. Those have grown since the state really got into the community college capital construction business back in the mid-2000s. They still represent a very small portion of the overall total state budget for community college, but a growing portion. And the difference between the 15-17 and 17-19 GRB bars here, the total height of those bars, is just the difference, just the increase in debt service since the governor's budget proposed funding the Community College Support Fund, the green bar, at the same level. That becomes a much more significant feature when we look at the public university state funding. And of course, the state has a much longer history of capital investments in state-funded capital investments in our public universities, and that has grown over the same time period to the point where it's become a fairly significant component of the state investment in public universities. This is, again, the same data, but focused on our public universities, the same time period. You see essentially the same trends with the very wrenching cuts in state funding in the 07, really 08 to 2011 time period. That diminishment of state support for our public universities in that four-year time frame may be unmatched by decreases in other aspects of the state budget. I mean, it was a very significant reduction in state funding for public universities. And on the coming out of that in 2013 and 15, you see these very significant increases in state funding for public universities to the point where our overall capital debt service plus university support levels are now back to pre-recession levels.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So just so I understand this clearly, so the two bars there that talk about $706.4 million, that's not, well, it's in addition to the debt. So the total amount the state is spending is increasing, but the amount available for operations doesn't necessarily increase.
Representative Lively, Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, correct.
People forget, I mean, it's been, what, a decade since the Great Recession was at its bottom? People forget that this was the worst recession by far since 1929. I mean, it was horrible. I was here, and it was not any fun cutting education like we had to do.
Senator Monroe, members of the committee, before I leave this slide, there's one last thing I want to say about the data here, because it's slightly different than the perspective that you may see from the public universities themselves. Number one, we have included debt service as part of the overall state budget and are depicting the history that way, which is may not be the typical approach that has been taken in the past. The other piece here is that in this enrollment line, that FTE enrollment, we're only including resident students. Mm. So if you include the non-resident students, you'd actually see a stronger upward trend because that population has continued to grow even as we've leveled off and even slightly declined in terms of resident enrollment at public universities. So it's just a slightly more sort of Oregon-focused view of the data. And that probably becomes particularly important on the next slide when we translate what you just saw into per FTE, per resident FTE data. And this gets back to your question.
Thank you. And so I always need to clarify this. So when we are talking about residents, we are talking about in-state students or students who live on campus?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee, yes, in-state students, okay. Which we call resident students.
Thank you. Yeah.
And isn't it true that, like at U of O, that more than half of their students are from out of Oregon?
Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Smith Warner, at the undergraduate level, I believe it's about 50-50. So I think it's slightly more than 50% are resident students at the University of Oregon. And we have that data in a subsequent presentation.
Senator Roblin.
So definition of resident students. So if a student moves here as a freshman, is an out-of-state student, and then they live here for the next couple of years, change, do they become resident students?
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, I'm not an expert on the residency rules. The universities themselves, in a sort of consortium, as a consortium, have established and maintained the residency definition. It's a very consequential one, obviously, for students and their families. I believe it is the case that a student, an undergraduate student who comes to Oregon as a freshman from out of state, remains a non-resident student for the duration of their undergraduate degree, and it would require additional sort of years and times of residency here before they were able to establish resident status.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I do believe that what you just explained, that is the case, which leads me to the question of, because those students are paying additional tuition and sort of offsetting the cost of what the legislature is doing, are our Oregon students losing birth spots that could be available to them, but for the fact that there needs to be some sort of revenue mix at the universities to attend, and so we have to get X percent from out of state to sort of offset the costs, which is leaving Oregon kids from not being accepted who otherwise would qualify based on admission requirements to our Oregon universities. I hear that from parents who have concerns that their child is otherwise academically qualified to go to one of our Oregon universities and then does not receive acceptance.
Representative Parrish, members of the committee, I will give a perspective on the question, and I would encourage you to put it to the universities themselves when they present. They may have a different perspective or not. But I would say this. First of all, when we look at our seven public universities as a system, lowercase s, because it's not a system, but if we look at them collectively, there are spaces for Oregon resident students who meet the academic qualifications. There are institutions, public Oregon universities, that would love to have them. When you look at the most competitive of those institutions, University of Oregon and OSU, it becomes, I think, possible to infer that the increasing reliance on out-of-state students has made it more challenging for Oregon resident students to find admission. However, your question itself noted the reliance that those institutions have on those non-resident out-of-state students for funding, in part to fund spots for Oregon students. So it seems to me not to be true that if we were to, for example, reduce or eliminate the non-resident population at University of Oregon or Oregon State University, that we would miraculously have more spots for Oregon students. In fact, their budgets would crater, which would force them either to significantly increase tuition for Oregon resident students or reduce access. So it is certainly a there are hydraulics here that I think, you know, you can look at and say, well, gosh, it's become harder for the Oregon resident student to gain access to those competitive institutions. But the answer seems pretty clearly not to be that we should be reducing spots for non-residents. I don't think that translates into more spots for residents simply because of the financial interests at stake.
I guess the follow-up commentary, more than a question, is, you know, when we sort of pit students against each other like that, and we're asking any student in-state or out-of-state to incur that level of debt, and maybe for a degree we're going to confer that doesn't actually translate into world of workplace skills, I guess, to me, this is a bigger question problem that we should be having the conversation around higher ed funding, because I have concern with any student we're asking to shoulder the debt service for healthcare costs that are out of control, for PERS, for all of these things, and we're, you know, we're asking non-resident students to shoulder costs for the guy at the DMV is sort of morally unconscionable to me. So I mean, I hope we will start to begin to have a more robust conversation about tuition. I get that it's based on funding, but I mean, I'd like to see what those numbers really would look like if we weren't so heavily reliant on asking kids from Wisconsin or whatever to debt service all of the other state costs that are rolled into the university system that may or may not have anything to do with their tuition at all, but they're just part of the larger PERS system, or they're part of PEB, or, you know, and they're offsetting. I mean, the universities have come to us and asked to be out of PEB, for example. The $100 million is what one CFO told me this year. If they were out of PEB, we're asking those out-of-state students to debt service that. And I don't care where the student comes from, to load that much debt onto any kid, to me, is just, is a problem.
Mr. Wilson?
I was just going to put, Mr. Chair, members, put some perspective around the dependence of out-of-state tuition for U of O in 2016. The report they had showed that the resident tuition contributed $104 million to the school's education general fund. Out-of-state was $280
million.
So it's significant.
So it sounds like we got a kind of Hobson's choice. If we didn't have those significant numbers of out-of-state students, the university would have to either significantly cut programs or significantly increase tuition for in-state students, thus probably reducing the number of in-state students that could matriculate there. I don't know. It's there's no easy answer. There's no easy answer unless we want to pony up a lot more money from the state.
Or we could let the universities serve, you know, sever ties from some of the state institutions where we're asking kids to pick up the tab for other state workers and debt service that.
Okay. All right. You show me how to do that.
I always have a bill for that.
Okay. All right. Good. Representative Hernandez.
This is why we need revenue reform.
Or cost containment.
Absolutely with you on that one. Mr. Cannon.
Thank you. Slide 53 describes the takes essentially the same data you've just seen of the overall state appropriation for by sector, including debt service, and now displays it on a per resident or fundable in the community college context FTE basis. So on a per student basis, the state investment. You'll see a couple of things. The universities are the green bar. The community colleges are the red bar. Number one, we, as a state, invest more per student in public universities than we do in community colleges.
My page 53 is different from that one. Is your page, is, are yours the same? That looks like my 52.
Yeah, there's one page difference. So.
What page are you on?
That's what I've got, 53. Mine's the same.
Yeah. Mine's 52.
Doug says 52. It's
okay. 52 on mine.
And Doug's.
We did upload a new version this morning as they sent over it.
Okay.
I'm not sure the timing, so.
Okay.
Apologies for the confusion. Senator Roblin, members of the committee, I don't think there are any substantive difference between the slides themselves, so but just the number. Again, this is state investment by sector per student. So now looking at just our resident students and the state investment per student. This is inflation adjusted, but it uses a more conventional consumer price index inflation adjustment. You see here, number one, we do invest more, considerably more in our public universities per student than our community colleges. Number two, you see some pretty strong ups and downs and overall in the university sector, a stark decline from the over $9,000 per student that we invested in 1999 to the about $7,000 in the current biennium. The CSL and GRB numbers for 2017-19 are included here for context. The community college funding per student has likewise suffered from some of the same instability. While the dips don't look quite as significant, actually, as orders of magnitude, they are similar, and that decline between 2007 and 2011 reflected that big surge in FTE enrollment, as well as declining state funding that really put community colleges in a pinch. As enrollments have declined and state funding increased in 2015, they enjoyed a more robust and budget environment over the last couple of years, but are certainly facing challenges in the
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So the way I read this assumes that those students that are from out of state or aren't residents are paying the full cost, so there's no cost loaded in. But my understanding is amongst universities that's not necessarily true. They don't all charge out of state or out of resident students at like the University of Oregon is. I don't know.
Representative Lively, co-chairs, this slide doesn't have data about or make assumptions about the non-resident out-of-state students. However, your larger point about their tuition costs is correct. While a non-resident student at the University of Oregon or Oregon State University will pay that sort of much higher, 20-some thousand dollars tuition, many non-resident students at Oregon public universities pay a much lower rate. Through the university's participation in a Western interstate agreement, the Western Undergraduate Exchange, that allows Oregon students to pay much lower rates as at public institutions in Arizona and Colorado and Utah, et cetera, and likewise allows their students to pay a much lower rate. It's about 1.5 times, or maybe exactly 1.5 times, the resident rate. So instead of 9,000, it would be closer to 14,000. But that actually is the primary way that a non-resident student at, for example, Southern Oregon University would pay. We've done the same analysis for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the state's primary need-based grant, so presented our state investment here on a per FTE basis. We can talk about that 2007 to 2011 time period in more depth either now or when we look at the Oregon Opportunity Grant in greater detail, but essentially the state made a major new commitment to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and then many, many thousands more students showed up and qualified for it than had been expected. The program was not it was not successfully managed given the sort of spike in enrollment and in need during that time, and as a result there was a big increase and then there was a sharp diminishment in order to catch up with the funding issues that big increase had created. Since 2011, we've been on a sort of steadier trajectory of increasing state funding, slightly decreased or sort of stable levels of enrollment and need. And you see that we're investing in the university sector about $580 per student, in the community college sector about $383 per student. We'll have a lot more data about the Oregon Promise and its adequacy coming up in our affordability presentation. To kind of put it all together, so you're likely familiar with press reports about Oregon's ranking for higher education appropriations per student. Though that ranking takes into account everything we've just talked about: support for community colleges, support for public universities, and support for state scholarship programs. And in the most recent published report, Oregon ranked 45th. That's the sort of oft-cited Oregon kind of near the bottom of in investment per student. However, that most recent published report did not take into account the reinvestments that were made by the 2015 legislative session. The report lags by a couple of years. In working with the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association that publishes the report, we are able to describe that in the soon-to-be-released 2016 or 2017 report, Oregon will move up to 37th. As a result of the reinvestments that were made by the 2015 legislature in the Oregon Opportunity Grant, in the Public University Support Fund, and the Community College Support Fund. So that's the news that will be reported here in the next few weeks or a month. You'll see at the bottom of this table that 37, that's our educational appropriations per FTE, our rank. You'll also see that We are a high tuition state at number 21 in tuition revenue per FTE. Not surprising, given that we're a low educational appropriations per FTE. And we're overall sort of near the middle or slightly below the middle in total educational revenue per student in number 30. So when you combine state investment and student investment via tuition, we work out to be number 30 in total educational revenue per FTE. This is, Oregon is not a high spending state on higher education, even when you include our relatively high tuition.
Right.
This is the 2015 data with Oregon number 45, and then we use the little red, you know, outline there to describe where Oregon will sit in the upcoming soon-to-be-released report that will show us at number 37. Just a few more national comparisons, and these two slides really emphasize the point that Oregon is a low public investment, low public aid, and high tuition state. This is comparison with Western states, and you see them listed on the right-hand side of the slide. But in terms of state and local appropriations per student, again, Oregon significantly lags that Western average. Our appropriations at slightly under $4,800. Financial aid, a big gap between Oregon and our Western counterparts in terms of state investment per student in grant aid, going back to 2014-15. And then tuition, we're higher. And these things are not coincidences. When you're a low public investment state, you are likely to be a high tuition state. There is a very clear relationship between the two across the country in every state, and Oregon is no exception. You see that our average resident undergraduate tuition and fees at our two-year institutions is nearly double the Western state average, and at our four-year institutions, this graph is misleading. I apologize for that, because it's not double. It's only slightly higher, but still outpaces the Western state's average for tuition and fees. Just a final sort of piece of history when it comes to national comparisons, and most of the data we've presented only goes back to 99, but just to take one step back before we start going down into the weeds, one final step back to the big picture. This tracks state appropriations per students going back now to 1989, Oregon versus the national average, and it reinforces the point that one of you made when we at the outset of this section about the 1990 Senator Monroe, that what started to occur in 1990. At that time, Oregon basically tracked a national average in state appropriations per student. That gap began to emerge in the 1990s and has continued to today and widened, so that Oregon significantly lags the national average in state appropriations per student. When it comes to need-based aid, Oregon against the national average, we're in the bottom third for need-based grant dollars. That's the Oregon rank number 33 with roughly $159 per 18 to 24-year-old in Oregon. So again, just to underscore the point, we're low state investment, low institutional funding, high tuition, low aid state, and that's true essentially no matter how you look at it. Our final slides for today, unless the committee wants to forge on, which we're prepared to do as we turn to a kind of deeper dive on affordability. But the final slides in this deck are just a kind of review of major components of the higher education budget, so the HEC budget. And I showed you this yesterday at the outset. These are the major components, the 2015-17 LAB, then our 2017-19 CSL and GRB. You see the major chunks there. Here they are depicted, and you'll see this versions of this slide as we move through the next days of presentation for each of our major investment streams. But starting at the top is the Community College Support Fund. That is the primary state investment in community colleges. It was $550 million in 2015-17. The CSL for this at 564, almost 564, and the GRB at 550. You see here just in the next row the percentage changes that the GRB represents, both against LAB and CSL. There is an additional in the second line here. There's an additional $5.8 million in our CSL for targeted investments in student success at community colleges. That's a decrease from the $14.3 million in 2015-17, but that's the result of one-time investments that were phased out of this category in the 2017-19 CSL budget and in the GRB. And then the final line of major sort of state funding for community college or community college-related activities is the debt service that was shown on a previous slide. That is not optional, so perhaps we should start with that. That's sort of baked in, and that's that will rise to $43.8 million in the 2017-19 budget, the majority of which is general fund, a portion of which is lottery funds.
And let me comment there. You notice debt service has risen pretty dramatically in the last couple of biennia. That was not accidental. Many of us that agreed to that were looking at what the interest rates were, and interest rates for the kind of money that we're borrowing were very, very low, historically low. And so the decision was that it made sense to do some investing in capital if we could do it with borrowed money at 1 or 1.5% interest. And the legislature collectively made the decision to go ahead with those. That's why you're seeing debt service being considerably higher than it was a few biennia ago. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director Cannon, slide wheel on 62. It doesn't matter, 62 or 63. I think it should be significant that when you're looking at state support for community colleges, that some way you let people that are giving the briefing and let or put out to the public. The legislature in 2009 or 11, Senator Monroe, was started contributing to construction with debt backing, but that was a lot of money that went to community colleges was not going there before that the state made that commitment to do. I think that's, if you look at those amounts of money, that would be, as we're talking about here, the debt service on that. But that was a tremendous step for this body to get into the capital construction business for community colleges.
The next slide contains or describes a couple of the major funds that the HEC administers for our public universities. There are some significant dollars that are not on this slide that we'll get into when we look at the public university budget more specifically. But here you see on the top the primary source of state funding for public universities is the Public University Support Fund. It was at just over $667 million in the current biennium. The CSL for this is $693 million, and the GRB is flat funded at $667 million. So no change from the legislatively approved budget, and almost 4% decrease from CSL. The second, or the bottom half of this slide, is the debt service. And here the sort of similar phenomenon, previous commitments by the legislature to invest in public university capital that results in ongoing debt service costs to the state, mostly general fund, some lottery fund, increasing by about 22% between 2015-17 and 2017-19, and now just over $193 million in the upcoming budget. On the financial aid side, the two major state-funded financial aid programs that we administer, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which was about $141 million in the current biennium, and will rise at the CSL level to $146 million under the GRB. There's an additional increase of 3.4% to bring it to $151 million. That reflects the governor's emphasis within this budget on serving the lowest income students, the highest need students, with targeted need-based financial aid. And then the Oregon Promise grant program, which in the current budget was had an initial investment of $9.5 million. This slide could be updated to reflect the supplemental investment that the legislature just approved and that awaits the governor's signature in order to fully fund the first year of the program, to the tune of about $13 million in scholarship funds through the Oregon Promise. The CSL for this program is technically at $20 million, but as we've explained to the Ways and Means Committee and as and the legislature, that would not fully serve all students that the program is intended for. And so we developed an initial estimate of about $40 million for the GRB to continue to fund those students. That is likely not sufficient, given what we know now about the take-up of the program, the pickup of the program by graduates of the high school class of 2016 who are in their first year at community college. And so we'll be working with Doug and the committee to update these numbers to reflect that a truer picture of the full cost of continuing the program. And of course, should the legislature make policy changes to the program, either to expand eligibility or diminish eligibility, it would affect that number either direction.
And once again, this Oregon Promise that Senator Robden and I worked very hard on, along with Senator Hass in particular, is reformational. And we borrowed it basically from the Tennessee experience, and it's designed ultimately to move toward a situation where no Oregon student that wants to go to college that has at least a 2.5 high school GPA is denied a college education. That's pretty dramatic. That's our goal, and Oregon Promise is heading that direction. And when you set up a program like that, it's very attractive to a lot of students. And so we found that a greater number of students applied than we had funded. And so we're having to catch up in terms of the funding, and that's difficult right now. But I remain committed to the Oregon Promise. I know Senator Roblin as well. Go ahead, Senator Roblin.
So if we track the amount of federal money that mm-hmm. has come in and increased because of this?
Senator Roblin, co-chairs, yes, not precisely, because we don't right. Collect that federal money. It does not pass through the state, but we do have ways of, we can approximate the number of Oregon Promise students, for example, that are eligible for and receiving federal Pell Grants. And when we look at the Promise, we'll do that. And we'll see that the very significant number of federal dollars that are really helping to fund these students. As you know, the Oregon Promise is on the state side is a last dollar program. It fills in where the federal Pell Grant leaves off.
Yep.
And but it relies very heavily on the Pell Grant in order to make community college near free for its eligible students.
And follow.
Go ahead.
Do we also include the money that comes from Promise when we're talking about our poorest students, because there is at least $1,000 for each of those students that goes into their funding? And previously on the previous slides, it showed how much we were investing in our neediest students. Is that extra money included in that, or is it just from the other grant?
Senator Roblin, co-chairs, members of the committee, yes, we've included all state scholarship funding, including that $1,000 minimum for the lowest income students and the rest of the Oregon Promise scholarship funding in that depiction of state scholarship funding per student or relative to other states. As these numbers reflect, the Oregon Promise grant program, for all its attention and significance, remains actually a relatively minor part of the state scholarship budget in comparison with the, for example, Oregon Opportunity Grant. Clearly, though, if we're to continue the program for all recent high school graduates, it will become a much more significant part right. of scholarship funding in the state of Oregon.
Yes.
So, can I ask one more question?
more question about that. Thank you. And when we either get to the promises part of this or in future, we'll also get a sense, a breakdown of who indeed is receiving it and what levels of FAFSA they're getting, what kind of socioeconomic levels, so how much we're spending on which kids.
Representative Smith Warner, Senator Monroe, yes, we'll provide that in quite a bit of detail.
Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Monroe, we are at a sort of potential stopping point now. We're also prepared to move on into the next day's presentation. So
I think this is a good time to pause and come back tomorrow. Anything further for the good of the order, Mr. Wilson?
No, except that there will be public testimony, make sure which day, either Tuesday or Wednesday of next week, on what you'll cover up to them, which is the affordability and some of the transitional, or I'm not sure what they were calling it, but that part of the presentation. So be ready. The general community college and public university testimony will come on other days later on.
And Representative Smith Warner and I are working with Mr. Wilson on some preliminary cuts to education budgets and what we want to absolutely protect and what may have to be trimmed a little bit. Again, this is all perspective because we're just doing our job at this point with known revenue. And we all hope that when the final budget is passed in late June or early July, that there'll be additional revenue and that we'll be able to restore some of the cuts that we're now being forced to propose. That's just the way the system works. And if any of you members of this committee have particular input that you want to give Barbara or I in terms of what should be cut or should not be cut, please let us know. Thank you very much, and we're adjourned until tomorrow. Close the public hearing on 5524 and adjourned. 5524 and adjourned. Public hearing on 5524.